This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
A dollar here, a dollar there. Pretty soon, you're talking real money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today, the 22nd day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have been on this program over the past couple of days talking a lot about bonds, about bond yields in particular, and how they've been going up. Higher interest rates up for a whole lot of reasons. But what does that mean, do you suppose, in real life? Well, here's one thing. When rates rise in normal times, the U.S. dollar gets stronger. It becomes more attractive for traders. And for a while, the dollar did get stronger. It got so much stronger, in fact, that a lot of big multinationals were complaining that the dollar was too strong. So strong it was making a dent in their overseas profits. But we have not been hearing many of those complaints this year because the dollar has been falling even though interest rates are still high. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains what's going on there.
The Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes usually push up the dollar. But right now, the Fed isn't the only central bank that's raising rates.
The rest of the world has started to play catch-up and try to keep up with the Fed.
That's Juan Perez, director of trading at Monex USA. The European Central Bank has been raising rates, which has pushed up the value of the euro. Same with the Bank of England and the pound. Perez says the Mexican peso has been rising too, largely because
Mexico is an economy that has a gross domestic product growing above 3%.
A weaker U.S. dollar could help out any company that exports, since it makes those products cheaper. Kenneth Rogoff, an economics professor at Harvard, says it makes services cheaper, too.
If you are a music performer and you're doing a tour in Europe and you charge in dollars, you're going to be more competitive.
U.S. importers, on the other hand, might have to pay more for the products they bring in. And that can make them hold off.
We haven't purchased as much equipment.
That's Greg Warwick, CEO of the equipment supplier TMB Baking, which imports a lot of items from Europe. Warwick says he's not concerned, in part because he bought a lot of equipment back in September when the euro was cheap.
So we feel comfortable with the inventory that we have of items like spiral mixers and some of those types of items where we purchased forward considerably.
Even though the dollar's value has been weakening, it's also becoming more stable. Megan Schoenberger is a senior economist with KPMG.
Large fluctuations in currency don't really benefit anybody because it makes it harder to do business.
Schoenberger says a more stable dollar helps out importers, exporters, and companies that do both. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We got our monthly update on the housing market today, courtesy of the National Association of Realtors. The details will sound familiar to regular listeners of this program. Existing home sales in July were way down, off about 17% from a year ago. The national median home price was up a bit, about 2% year on year. Home sales have, of course, been slow for a while now, mostly because mortgage rates have been high for a while now. And as the average rate on a 30-year fixed cracks 7% again this month, there is a familiar refrain, once again entering the chat for would-be homebuyers. Well, look, it goes. You can always refinance. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
It's been a very long time since mortgage rates were this high. Think the turn of the century from the late 90s through 2001. So you'd forgive home buyers for already considering a refi, even before, you know, the original FI? Mike Fratantoni is chief economist with the Mortgage Bankers Association.
You hear a lot of folks in the industry talking about date the rate, marry the house, right? You're going to be in the house for a long period of time, but you may be in this mortgage just for a couple of years.
Date the rate, marry the house, aka eat the high monthly payment to get a foot in the door and then refinance after the Fed declares inflation officially whipped.
So if you can find a home that you like, you can afford it. And then plus you have this option going down the road of potential refinance if rates drop. That's a pretty good combination.
And if rates don't drop, well, you still have the house on a 30-year fix. There's even date the rate, marry the house memes on housing social media. Sacramento realtor Aaron Stumpf is not a fan.
I think it's a little misleading. I mean, the market fluctuates.
Stumpf says even if mortgages get cheaper, so might your house, which would complicate a refi. And she's still scarred from that you can always refinance mantra that contributed to the foreclosure crisis.
2007 was 16 years ago. So I think that, you know, maybe has faded from people's memories a little bit more, but I certainly remember what it was like.
The good news is borrowers are much better credit risk than they were in the late 2000s, and banks are much more choosy about who gets a mortgage in the first place. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
In other news, there's housing social media and memes. Learn something new every day in this job. Wall Street Today. Kind of lackluster, actually, as if traders were waiting for a certain speech by a certain chair of a certain central bank come the end of the week. Okay, fine. It's Jay Powell, the Fed's big conference in Jackson Hole. Speech is Friday. Anyway, equities, bonds, etc. when we do the numbers. Hey, you remember all those stories here and elsewhere about how shopping malls were dying? Yeah, about that. Maybe we were a bit hasty. There's some new analysis out from CoreSite Research. It's a retail research firm that says foot traffic at what it calls top-tier malls is above where it was in the before times and that occupancy rates are at 95% or higher. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked into what might be giving malls a second life.
Joe Bell has been in the mall business for 15 years. And in that time, he's gotten the same question over and over.
I've had people who were asking me what I was going to do when all the malls closed in 5 years.
Rude, but also maybe fair. The narrative about dying malls has been going strong for more than a decade. But Bell, a spokesperson for Cafaro Company, which operates 50 shopping centers, says foot traffic is back to pre-COVID levels. He says a successful mall is one that's been reimagined.
It would feel a lot more like a typical downtown, where you have a greater variety of types of businesses, where you might find a bar and restaurant right next to it, a jewelry store, and next to that, a dentist's office.
One of their malls even has a minor league ballpark. Sonia Lipinski at Alex Partners says for the first time since 2016, more stores are opening than closing. So have malls escaped death?
It's not kind of a one-size-fits-all answer. So it's very nuanced.
Malls in urban areas where people value delivery and have less money, they're not doing as well. While malls in more affluent suburban areas are thriving, they're seeing an influx of luxury and direct-to-consumer brands like Away Luggage. Lipinski says online brands are boosting occupancy rates.
They've realized that it's too expensive to acquire the consumer only exclusively from a digital channel.
These brands are especially successful at combining the features of online and in-person shopping, like incentivizing online pickup orders and returns and showing what's available in store. Claire Tassin is with Morning Consult.
So if I am browsing online and I see, you know, a pair of jeans I want to try on, hopefully that site is showing me that my local mall has those in stock and gives me a reason to go in.
I mean, if someone figures out a way to avoid having to try on jeans at all, I'm here for it. Until then, to the mall. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
If that mall rebound Kristen was just telling us about shows us anything, it's that Americans want to get out of the house. For some, that's a trip to the mall. For others, maybe it's a trip to a forest or a lake, which admittedly do have their own costs. According to the U.S. Forest Service, we spend more than $600 billion on outdoor recreation every year. But what if, even with all the options you have to spend your money on, you still can't quite find what you're looking for? That brings us to the latest installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Dylan Demery. I'm the founder and owner of She's Fly, a fly fishing company based in Fort Collins, Colorado. My husband died in 2009, and he fished, and I never did. I started using his regular spin reel because I wanted to connect with him and maybe with myself in a way that I hadn't before. I had two of my great friends come out fishing with me, and they'd be out there fly fishing, and I thought, man, I want to try that out. I found that with fly fishing, it was so meditative. The breath work, the casting, so it really helped me process my grief, and it helped me heal through that time. As I progressed in my fly fishing journey, I eventually wanted to buy gear. So I was looking for women's waders, and I couldn't really find them. I would mostly find men's that were too big in order to get over my curves. And it just felt really unsafe, uncomfortable. And I started thinking there has to be a better way to do this. And that's really where She's Fly came about. For the money side of this business, I still have a day job that I'm working full time, and that's how I'm paying for this. So I'm spending money as little as I can to see how sales go. And then I use the money from sales that goes right back into the business. So I think this year, our third year, we'll probably finish the year between 35 and 40,000 in sales. We didn't make much money the first 4 months that we opened the business. But then the next year, I think we tripled it. And then the year after that, we almost tripled. And then this year, I think we were on a good trajectory, but then we hit a snag where it rained for 2 months and delayed our snowpack from melting. I think there were some good, maybe 2 weeks of really great fishing, but it's been kind of odd. And then with the economy in general, we've seen less spending in this area this year. But we're still probably on track to match last year, if not beat it. The future for this company, I think if we're consistently making $300,000 a year, that means we can do this full time. And I'd like that to happen in the next 5 years. I really do think that this is in our grasp, and I don't think I would keep doing it if I didn't. Like, yes, it's my baby. I'm very passionate about what we're doing. I really love the healing aspect of the sport and how I can share that with people with my story. But really, being able to do that full time would be a dream.
That's a cool story. Dylan Demery of She's Fly out in Fort Collins, Colorado. Do this series without you, we cannot. So let us know what's going on, would you? There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
Sort of everywhere you look, plastic is being introduced.
And introduced and introduced and introduced. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 174 today, about a half percent, 34,288 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 8 points, just shy of 1/10 of 1%, 13,505. The S&P 500 gave up 12 points, almost 0.3%, 43.87. Malls might be doing all right, as Christian Schwab is just telling us, but a couple of retailers you'll find in or around said malls, not so much. Dick's Sporting Goods cut its profit projection for the year. Shares gave up more than 24%. That's not a typo, 24%. Macy's kept its estimates in place, but also stood by its gloomy expectations for consumer spending. Shares down 14% there. Five regional banks just got their credit ratings cut by S&P Global Ratings 2 weeks after Moody's did pretty much the same thing. The downgradees include Dallas-based Comerica and Cleveland-based KeyCorp, both of which slid 0.4%. The news dragged down bigger banks as well. JPMorgan Chase gave up almost 0.2%. Bond prices went up today. That means the yield goes down. The 10-year T-note, 4.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The phrase to know for this next story is real wages, worker pay after accounting for inflation. During the distressing peak of those rising prices, overall real wages lagged, and they lagged a lot. Even though paychecks were going up, prices were going up more. This spring, though, that trend turned around, and average hourly earnings started outpacing the consumer price index. That is welcome news for low-income Americans in particular, who are most affected by inflation. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, they are still playing economic catch-up and coming from way behind to do it.
Jose Quiñones has seen two financial crises unfold recently for the families that his organization, the Mission Asset Fund, serves in the low-income immigrant neighborhoods of San Francisco. First, there was the pandemic, with job losses and lower paid service occupations, and the difficulty many undocumented temp and contract workers faced getting benefits.
In a time when the federal government was supporting families, these were the folks that were actually excluded from any sort of help.
Then employment rebounded, but
as they were able to recoup some of their financial lives, now in the current crisis of inflation and just this fear of a recession, they're again pooling resources in families and communities.
Quiñones has seen family finances deteriorate in the face of inflation, even as price increases have started to moderate.
It's hit them really hard, for sure. The people that are really dependent on driving to work or using their cars, inflation is impacting them more. Even if the rents do come down, I mean, they're coming down by $50 or $100. They're not something that is more affordable.
And here's the thing. With inflation now falling, middle and upper income consumers are spending more, worrying less about high prices and looking for fewer discounts. But this is not true of consumers at the bottom.
It's really that lowest income group that seems to be falling behind.
Kayla Brune at polling firm Morning Consult says among households earning less than $50,000 a year, high prices are still a big problem.
It's about the duration of living with high prices. So even as inflation slows, they're still playing catch up. They've worked their way through their savings. They're increasingly likely to walk away from purchases.
And even though post-pandemic wage gains have been relatively strong, especially in lower-wage service jobs, these folks are now less financially secure. For example, says Brune, when these households are faced with an emergency household expense,
the lowest income group was least likely to say they'd be able to cover it with cash, 47%, so that they might not be able to pay off some of their other bills if they faced a $400 expense, which is pretty striking, I think.
They'd have to cut other expenses, dip into savings, borrow from friends and family, or add to credit card debt. Jose Quiñones sees all these strategies among the families he serves and more.
Selling off cars, sometimes even equipment just to like pay off the rents, pool risk so that they can minimize expenses. But it's difficult. It's like, how many people can you have in your one-bedroom apartment? You know, 3, 4, 5, 10.
Quiñones says another way poor families increase their financial resilience is with small businesses and side hustles. Juan Carlos Pacheco, an immigrant from Peru, got help from the Mission Asset Fund to get his solo catering business, Ceviche Pacha, off the ground. But he says he faces mounting costs for insurance and access to a commercial kitchen, so the business doesn't cover his bills.
It's not sufficient because I don't get enough work. So I never stop looking for extra jobs.
Pacheco finds temporary work in restaurants as a line cook and in other service jobs, but his pay varies from week to week depending on how much work he finds. He shares an apartment with two roommates and says the rent has recently gone up.
Prices, that's been hard for me because I don't work more than 40 hours a week at a regular job, and so I need to work in my catering business just to survive.
And even as price inflation continues to cool, Jose Quiñones says low-income families can't lower their guard.
They need to prepare themselves for the next crisis, right? Because it's not just once it's over, everything's back to normal. It's more like they just have to get ready for the next one.
Whether that's a recession, job loss, or the rent going up again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You almost can't turn around in this economy without plastic getting involved somehow. It holds many of the goods that we buy, the food and drink we pick up to take home. It's in our cars, in our homes, in our offices, and it never goes away. Suzanne Rust covers the environment at the Los Angeles Times, where she recently cataloged all the plastic she and her family used in a week. It was a lot. Suzanne, welcome to the program. Good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So you have this conversation with your editor about doing a story maybe on plastic and your daily plastic interactions. I want you to tell me what happened that very first day you started to try to diary this when you were sitting at your desk.
It was a little horrifying. I am an environment reporter, and I've written about plastic for years. And so I'm aware of plastic in the environment, aware of plastic in my house. And I thought it was actually pretty good at minimizing my plastic exposure. But when I sat down to start this journal, I just looked around my desk and saw there was plastic everywhere. I looked at my computer screen, at the casings around my windows, at my shoes, my belt, the pants I was wearing. I mean, plastic was literally everywhere. And then as I went through the subsequent days, driving around, looking at the things in my car, all plastic, going swimming, all the equipment I use, all plastic, getting on a plane, I just became aware in a way that I hadn't been before how much I am surrounded by plastic all the time.
Were you surprised? I mean, obviously, intellectually, you knew it. But as you started concentrating on it, were you surprised at how much plastic there is?
Oh, yeah. And that was the thing, right? Yeah. Again, I was sort of intellectually aware of all of this. But as I started to take account, it was overwhelming.
Is it too pat to say that plastic, given all the ways we use it, and I think if anybody listening to this just sits down for more than 3 seconds, they will do the same thing you did, and I did once I read your article, which is just be overwhelmed. Is it too pat to say that plastic is the price of convenience?
That's a hard question to answer. I think in the moment, yes. We live lives where we look for ways to reduce our energy and efficiency all the time, and plastic is a really convenient solution for that. But I do know environmentalists and governments are trying to figure out ways to make lives equally convenient, but not requiring all of the plastic that we now use to have that convenience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. And look, when I asked it, I knew it was an impossible question, but, you know, that's kind of my job. the countervailing force here, though, for the environmentalists and the governments who are trying to help us help ourselves is that, as you note in this piece, plastics are a $600 billion industry, and it keeps on growing because we keep using more.
Well, we do keep using more, but I do think there is an awareness that more is getting into our environment, but more doesn't necessarily need to be there. So, for instance, I wrote about going to the grocery store, and I always get, you know, this big box of salad, and it comes in a big plastic box, but there are ways of providing that salad without using the box. Mm-hmm, I mean, it's just sort of everywhere you look, plastic is being introduced in places plastic doesn't necessarily need to be.
You actually called it in this piece, you called that diary keeping process soul crushing. And I guess my question is, yeah, you're laughing so you don't cry, right? Because the question is, what do we do?
Well, again, I mean, I think environmentalists are pushing governments to put a limit on the amount of plastic that is out there. I mean, there are definitely plastics that we all rely on now that we need, right? They make our cars lighter. They protect your head when you're riding your bicycle so you don't have to wear like a wooden helmet or a stone helmet or something, right? But there are ways of reducing these single-use plastics, which I think make up, I can't remember the number, but it might be like 45% of all the plastics that we put into the environment. And there are ways of reducing that. So things can be done. And in places like California, packaging laws have been enacted just to reduce those single-use plastics that, again, are not required for sort of functioning in our lives.
Suzanne Rust. She's an environment reporter at the Los Angeles Times, writing most recently about her experience trying to diary all her plastic use. It is a challenge. Suzanne, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which offices continue to be empty, really empty. Saw this on Bloomberg, a study from an Australian company that does workplace sensors, lights, alarms, those kinds of things. Data that shows that more than a third of desks in offices globally are unoccupied all week. 36%, in fact, of cubicles and desks are never used at all on this planet. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context in which the electric vehicle future draws ever closer. Maybe you heard of the Vietnamese EV maker that went public last week through a SPAC, VinFast, it's called. Shares were up another 108% today, giving it a market capitalization, which is, again, shares outstanding, times share price, of $167 billion. worth substantially less than $167 billion? GM and Ford put together. The caveat here, of course, is that the EV business is really hard. Also, volatility like that is not necessarily a good thing. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mieten and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of Digital and On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.